is the Voice of America in Washington, and you're listening to VOA Global. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson.
Hi, I'm Ira Melman. On today's program, the United States is asking China for help in preventing another computer hacking attack from North Korea. But will China be a willing partner? We'll hear more in a moment on Daybreak Asia.
There are reports that China is investigating possible stock price manipulation. We'll have that story for you, too.
Francis Alonso explores the situation that sees women and girls taking their own lives in some countries.
On China Focus, Sarah Williams talks to the author of a book about Madame Mao.
In the American Cafe, research that might allow us to communicate better with our dogs.
And pop music icon Joe Cocker has died. We pay tribute.
We'll check business and sports as well on this edition of VOA Global from the Voice of America.
Glad you could join me for another Daybreak Asia. Our summary of Asian news and events for Tuesday, December 23rd. I'm Jim Stevenson. In brief today, China has condemned cyber terrorism but says more proof is needed that North Korea hacked Sony Pictures. Its comments came a day after the United States asked China for help to block cyber attacks from the North. We hear more now from Shannon Van Sant from Beijing.
China says it opposes cyber attacks on third parties through making use of the facilities of another country. The comments from China's foreign ministry came after the United States accused North Korea of hacking Sony Pictures. China's foreign ministry spokesperson Hua Chunying said China opposes a country using the internal facilities of another country to launch cyber attacks. She said China is ready to carry out dialogue on this issue with other countries based on mutual trust and affirm that China will act in accordance with law on this issue. The foreign ministry's comments came after China confirmed a telephone conversation between Foreign Minister Wang Yi and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry late on Sunday night. During that call, Wang Yi also said China opposes cyber attacks. But in subsequent comments from the foreign ministry, China has not blamed North Korea for the Sony attack. When asked if China believed North Korea launched the cyber attack on Sony Pictures through Chinese servers, China's foreign ministry said China needed more facts before making any conclusions. Yesterday, U.S. President Barack Obama asked for China and several other countries to help block future cyber attacks from North Korea. China's help would be crucial. Much of North Korea's telecommunications runs through Chinese network systems, and U.S. officials say the hacking attack on Sony was routed through Chinese servers. Tensions have risen between the United States and China over cybersecurity, with each country accusing the other of hacking attacks. Xiaohe Chang, a professor of international relations at Renmin University, says this could provide an opportunity for China and the U.S. to improve ties on this issue.
North Korea's case serves as a convenient tool for China and the United States to restart their stalled conversations over cyberspace security that suspended a few months ago.
Chinese media coverage has been critical of the cyber attack on Sony Pictures, but an editorial in the state-run Global Times newspaper also wrote that the movie revealed the United States' cultural arrogance. The paper went on to write that some people in the U.S. have complained that China has been suppressing Hollywood's freedom of creativity through economic power. Actually, China should further stick to principles when dealing with Hollywood. Apparently, it is easier to show the U.S. the economic consequences than trying to reason with them. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
In South Korea, there are voices of support for the idea that President Barack Obama might put North Korea back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism in response to the cyber attack on Sony Pictures Entertainment. But as we hear from VOA's Brian Padden in Seoul, there are also voices urging restraint, saying Mr. Obama was correct in calling the hacking incident cyber vandalism.
South Korea has its own history with alleged North Korean cyber attacks. In the last 5 years, South Korean officials have accused North Korea of hacking into banks, government websites, and broadcasters, causing chaos and costing millions of dollars in damages. Perhaps the most infamous incident was a 2013 cyber attack known as Dark Seoul that virtually shut down 3 South Korean television stations and a bank, as well as affiliated ATMs and mobile payment plans. Korean Studies professor Andre Lankoff at Cookman University says the recent cyber attack against Sony Pictures in the United States does not make North Korea suddenly more dangerous, but it is raising the perceived threat level.
Threat level, no. Perceived threat level, yes. Because it's a usual problem of the Americans, and when America itself is targeted, they began to take it far more seriously.
The hacker cyber attack on Sony Corporation and threats of violence against theaters led to the cancellation of the release of the comedy movie The Interview that depicts the fictional assassination of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Bo Hyung-wook, an analyst at the Korea Institute for Defense Analysis, however, says the Sony cyber attack demonstrates an ongoing, increasing threat that so far is not being taken seriously enough by South Korea and the U.S. North Korea, he says, is enhancing its cyber attack capability while their readiness posture against cyber attack is weak. He says North Korea has trained over 3,000 cyber experts to spy on and attack foreign networks. The North Korean government has denied it was involved in the attacks and has threatened to strike back if the U.S. retaliates. But Lankoff says imposing new economic restrictions on top of existing U.S. sanctions in place on North Korea will have little impact.
The U.S. has already implemented a lot of sanctions with zero results. Well, it's possible to implement more sanctions with same result, that is, no result.
He is more in agreement with President Obama's description of the alleged North Korea hacking episode as a case of cyber vandalism, not an act of war. Brian Patton, VOA News, Seoul.
You may not be aware of it, but there's a decrease in rubber imports by China and other countries. It's being partly blamed for a crisis in Southeast Asia's rubber industry. Prices have been falling below production costs, as VOA correspondent Steve Herman explains from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
For rubber farmers in Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia, who supply two-thirds of the $36 billion annual market, this has been when their crop hit a dead bounce. Yum Tavarolet is the chief executive officer of the three-country International Rubber Consortium.
They are suffering from too low prices below cost of production because of the underprice from rubber futures or rubber exchanges.
Yum says that has forced some rubber farmers to put away their tapping knives.
They switch to other agricultural activities, some cutting down old rubber trees.
The consortium contends that speculators are skewing prices and that the ratio between supply and demand does not justify such low prices. But analysts contacted by VOA Monday say traders are taking a wait-and-see attitude because of a recent intervention in the market by Thailand's government under control of a military-led junta since a coup 7 months ago. China announced Friday it would double the volume of imports of agricultural products from Thailand next year, including rice and rubber. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia comes to you every weekday on VOA Global. You may also subscribe to it as a podcast for free at voanews.com.
Listening to the Voice of America from Washington, along with Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman. This is your segment. We'll read you a story we did and your reactions to some of those stories. First deals with North Korea. They're calling on the United States to apologize for implicating Pyongyang in the hacking of Sony Pictures and threatened to fight back in a variety of ways, including cyber warfare. A Rod from the UK says it seems obvious to me the U.S. should upgrade its cyber defenses, both corporate and government.
Well, China condemned cyber terrorism but said more proof is needed that North Korea hacked Sony Pictures. From our website, Paul Zhang, who is from Singapore, writes, does China truly condemn, as it is one in the past, has penetrated and cyber attacked in many cases?
Pakistan's Interior Minister Chaudhry Nisar Ali Khan warned of further attacks after a Taliban assault on a school in Peshawar last week left 141 dead, 132 of them children. Eric Zuckerman says, is the minister being a spokesman for the Taliban? It's a shame that for or more than a decade now, the Pakistan government, police, and army have tolerated terrorism by sacrificing life and property of its citizens. The Prime Minister of Pakistan is perhaps buying time for all of this to blow away when he stated he shall prepare an action plan in 7 days and will again form a committee. What a lurid and extravagant show of ineptness and incompetence.
Well, China has detained over 30,000 people during a 2-month clampdown on pornography and gambling, according to the state news agency Xinhua, which reported that story Sunday. Israel from Nigeria writes, pornography is one of the ungodly practices that needs to be eradicated not only from China, but from the world as a whole. Be sure to write to us at voaasia@voanews.com.
Did you do your Christmas shopping as yet?
A little bit. Not all of it. And you know what? We're only a couple days away.
Yeah. We went to the mall yesterday, and you couldn't even park, first of all. I think we walked 4 miles to get to the mall or whatever. And it was just so mobbed you couldn't do anything. But that's what people are doing in the United States. We're hearing now, there's a story that all of this is spreading to parts of Asia. Vietnam, apparently, ordering online. Thousands and thousands of people ordering Christmas gifts.
Welcome to this edition of Voice of America's Women Rising. I'm your host, Frances Alonzo. Earlier this year, the World Health Organization reported that a suicide takes place every 40 seconds in the world. China, Japan, India, and South Korea are listed as the Asian countries recording the highest number of suicides in 2012. What is pushing women and girls to see that suicide is the answer to their problems? Is this a true and accurate count of women and girls dying a preventable death? I pose those questions to Suzanne Petroni, the Senior Director of Gender, Population, and Development with the International Center for Research on Women. She breaks down the statistics and explains some of the causes of suicide among women and girls.
Suicide is now the leading cause of death among 15 to 19-year-old girls worldwide. Suicide now outpaces maternal mortality and HIV/AIDS-related causes as the major killer of girls in this age group. The suicide rate in South and East Asia is particularly shocking. Here, it's 5 times higher than it is in Europe or the Americas. So while the global average in this age group is 11.7 deaths from suicide per 100,000 15 to 19-year-old girls, in South and East Asia, suicide accounts for about 28 deaths per 100,000 girls.
What is it attributed to, do you think?
We don't actually know a whole lot about suicide across low- and middle-income countries. The evidence base is pretty thin, and partly this is due to the fact that the death records may not always attribute the cause of death to suicide, and partly it's because suicide attempts are not widely monitored by national health surveys. Only a third of countries ask about suicide attempts in the most widely used adolescent health surveys, and none of the countries in the Asia region asks about suicide attempts in these surveys. So we don't know a lot about the issue broadly in Asia. We do know more about it in India than elsewhere. Death rates from suicide are among the highest in the world for both adolescent girls and boys. We know that the prevalence of depression in children and adolescents has increased in India over the past 2 decades, as has the prevalence of suicidal behavior. We know from a study published this year that some 13 to 16% of adolescent girls and boys in India had symptoms of depression and post-traumatic stress, which is much higher than in other countries.
I'm sure mental health professionals have come up with a couple of theories. Do you know what those might be?
One of the theories, and in fact one that's fairly grounded in evidence across other regions, is that, you know, adolescence is this critical phase of development, and gender roles tend to become more differentiated, as does discrimination based on gender. So some of the things that you see in terms of gender-based discrimination during adolescence include increased risk of violence, child and forced marriage, sexual abuse and exploitation, limitations on reproductive control, exclusion from education or employment or decision-making, unequal chore burdens. All of these things are among the risk factors for suicide that we see from WHO.
Earlier, you mentioned the need for data. Why is data important? What would that information do for these children?
Collecting information can help us gain a better understanding of what is actually happening and what the drivers are of depression and self-harm, starting with vital registration, birth records, on up to health records and, fortunately, the death records, and making sure we have an accurate assessment and count of why individuals are dying is so important to helping us improve interventions and policies that can improve adolescent health.
That was Suzanne Petroni, the Senior Director of Gender, Population, and Development with the International Center for Research on Women. You can read the full WHO report at who.int. You can listen to this podcast and check out other podcasts of Women Rising at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonzo. Thank you for joining me on Women Rising.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. Chinese-American author An Chi Men has lived several lives in one life. Born in Shanghai in 1957, she spent time in a labor camp during the Cultural Revolution. She was chosen by Mao Zedong's powerful wife, Jiang Qing, to act in a film about workers. Following Jiang's loss of stature after Mao's death in 1976, Min left China to study in the United States. She eventually wrote a novel about Jiang, Becoming Madame Mao. Min stopped by VOA Studios recently, and I asked her about her early experience as an actress.
I was a peasant working the labor farm, and a crew of talent scouts from Shanghai Film Studio came in and picked me. And I was put in the group of hundreds of people, pretty much like a Miss America competition, except that the measurement was the opposite. I had to look like proletarian, which I did. And they measured how thick the callus was on my shoulder, and they saw my hands were filled with, you know, blisters and everything. But I didn't know how to act. The only thing I know was to recite Mao quotations and Mao poems. And I was selected to portray her ideal woman. Actually, it was for the film, for her to pave her way to take over China after Mao's death. So we started training and a screen test. I proved to be a lousy actress. By the way, I couldn't function. It was the only thing on my mind was, I better do what they say, or they're going to send me back to the labor camp. And I already have the injured backs, and I wanted to stay. But anyway, training started like early 1976, and then September 9th, 1976, Mao died. October 8th, Madame Mao was overthrown. And 2 months later, I was denounced as Madame Mao's trash.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you ever meet her?
I did not meet her, but I was told that all the film shots they sent to Beijing was considered horrible because we'd never seen a movie. We only saw the stage telegram, like a teleplay opera. But Madame Mao considered the footage awful, had the crew went to Beijing in her personal viewing theater, which was a surprise to me because I saw black sofa. They're kind of old. But we saw two movies, and before that two movies, we were told that do not be influenced, be poisoned. We are only there to learn the technique. And the camera learned the shooting, the actors learned the performing, and two movies was Madame Mao's favorite, which she imported from America. One was called Sound of Music, and the other was Jane Eyre. And of course, we were poisoned. And later on, when I wrote about my book, Becoming Madame Mao, which is portray Mao through Madame Mao's eyes, and the Madame Mao I knew, was that these two movies really reflect and was close to her life. Look, Madam Mao was 20 years younger than Mao, like Jane Eyre. And Mao's got a mad wife, Herzen. And Mr. Rochester in Jane Eyre had a mad wife up in the attic. And Madam Mao took over care of Mao's children. And Maria, in Sound of Music, took over the children. So that was a side of Madam Mao. She was evil. She was responsible for the murder of millions of people. But in the meantime, there's the other side of that evil. And what's really, I wouldn't say inspired, but that's the fact that I was very stunned by her, what she said, the last words when she was sentenced to death. It was a public trial televised nationwide. And she says, 我是主席的狗. She shouted, 我是主席的狗, 主席让我咬谁就咬谁. I am Mao's dog. Mao asked me to bite, I bit. And that's how she it's her self-portrait, and it could not be more perfect. She's a mad woman in a way, in the end. She was with Mao, followed him 38 years, and became a backyard concubine. She turned that resentment and hatred to any woman that she prosecuted, any woman who was in her way.
Author Anxi Min. Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
From Washington, this is the Voice of America, VOA Global, with Jim Stevenson. I'm Ira Melman. We check Asia business news. China is investigating possible stock price manipulation amid the recent run-up in that country's equity market. The Wall Street Journal attributes that to officials with direct knowledge of the matter. It's a move that serves as a stark reminder of the problems that have long haunted Chinese stocks. The probe launched by the China Securities Regulatory Commission comes as stocks traded in mainland China rallied to their highest level in 3 years Monday, despite that country's weakening economic growth. Much of the surge, analysts and officials say, has been triggered by short-term speculators betting on looser monetary conditions as opposed to investors with long-term belief in China's economy.
Asian markets were mostly higher Monday after the Fed's pledge not to rush to raise interest rates, and that prompted investors to add risky assets ahead of the year-end holiday. A rise in the price of oil boosted energy stocks. China's Shanghai Composite Index was up 1.6% to 3158. South Korea's Kospi added 0.7% to finish at almost 1944. Hong Kong's Hang Seng rose 1.5%. It sits at 23,452. Japan's Nikkei 225 dipped 0.1% at 17,610. Australia jumping as well, and stocks in Southeast Asia and Taiwan also rose.
Hong Kong is considering some new measures to promote the Shanghai-Hong Kong Stock Connect program, including relaxing the stock market access threshold for mainland investors. A spokesman for Hong Kong Exchanges and Clearing Limited said that in a statement emailed to the Global Times in the UK Monday. Currently, mainland investors need to have a portfolio value of over $80,000 to participate in the Stock Connect scheme. That is a look at Asia Business News.
This is Today in History. On December 22nd, 1769, a Sino-Burmese war ended in an uneasy truce. The war was considered a disaster for China, which lost more than 70,000 soldiers. The war laid the foundation for the present-day boundary between the two countries. In 1858, Italian composer Giacomo Puccini was born in Lucca, Italy. He is best known for the operas Madame Butterfly, La Boheme, and Tosca. The rebel city of Savannah, Georgia, fell to Union General William Tecumseh Sherman in 1864, concluding his famous March to the Sea during the American Civil War. On this date of that year, Sherman sent a message to President Abraham Lincoln saying, "I beg to present you as a Christmas gift the city of Savannah." In 1894, French Army officer Alfred Dreyfus was convicted of treason in a court-martial that triggered charges of anti-Semitism. In 1944, German troops demanded the surrender of American forces during the World War II Battle of the Bulge. The demand prompted the famous one-word reply by General Anthony McAuliffe, "Nuts."
In 1878, during the third plenum of the 11th National Congress of the Communist Party of China, Deng Xiaoping reversed Mao-era policies and pursued a program of Chinese economic reform. In 1989, Berlin's Brandenburg Gate reopened after nearly 30 years, effectively ending the division between East and West Germany. In 2001, Richard Reed attempted to destroy a passenger airliner by igniting explosives hidden in his shoes. In 2003, he was found guilty on terrorism charges and sentenced to multiple life terms. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
And now, VOA's International Edition. Coming up, internet outage in North Korea, results of Tunisia's election, plus the CAR Archbishop fighting militiamen. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. North Korea appears to be experiencing a widespread internet outage just days after President Obama warned the U.S. would retaliate for a cyber attack on Sony Corporation that was blamed on Pyongyang. The reason for the massive outage is not yet clear, but a U.S. State Department spokesperson, when asked about the situation, declined to comment. However, she did say the U.S. government is discussing a range of options in response to the Sony hacking, some of which, she said, will be seen and others may not be seen. For its part, North Korea Monday called on the United States to apologize for implicating Pyongyang in the hacking of Sony Pictures. It threatens to fight back in a variety of ways, including cyber warfare. The hackers who broke into the Sony computers call themselves the Guardians of Peace and warned there would be a bitter fate for anyone attending a public showing of the movie The Interview, a film in which the CIA hires two journalists to kill North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Sony canceled the scheduled December 25th release of the satirical comedy. Also in the news, veteran politician and staunch anti-Islamist Beji Caid Essebsi has been elected Tunisia's new president. Lisa Bryant has the story.
Official results give 88-year-old Beji Caid Essebsi nearly 56% of the vote in Sunday's runoff election, compared to 44% for incumbent interim president Moncef Marzouki. Secularist Essebsi was expected to win the vote and declared early victory as polls closed on Sunday.
Aujourd'hui, c'est le commencement de l'avenir.
In remarks broadcast by French TV, Mr. Essebsi said his election marked the start of Tunisia's future. He said he wants the nation to move forward united. He also saluted those who voted for his opponent. The vote closes Tunisia's somewhat rocky transition to democracy, nearly 3 years after a January revolution ousted longtime dictator Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. The vote triggered the wider Arab uprisings that have been marked by chaos, bloodshed, and setbacks in many countries. But Tunisia has moved ahead. This year, it completed a new constitution. It held legislative elections in October that saw Mr. Essebsi's secular Nida Tunis party emerge with the most votes. It beat the moderate Islamist El Nahda that has been in power for much of this post-revolution transition. In voting for Mr. Essebsi, analyst Anthony Dworkin of the European Council on Foreign Relations says Tunisians cast a vote for stability.
I think they went for a figure after 3 years of chaos and turmoil in the country, and little economic progress, some security problems. I think the attraction of Essebsi and his party was really that he was someone who could get the ship of state back on course.
Mr. Essebsi served under both former President Ben Ali and Tunisia's first post-independent president, Habib Bourguiba. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
U.S.-led coalition continued its air assault Monday near Iraq's Mount Sinjar a day after Kurdish Peshmerga fighters broke an Islamic State siege of the area. Around Iraq, seven more strikes on Monday targeted areas near al-Assad, Tal Afar, Ramadi, Mosul, and Fallujah. And in Syria, the latest air assault focused on the border city of Kobani, where six coalition strikes destroyed Islamic State fighting positions. Bomb at a bus station in Nigeria has killed at least 20 people, wounded another 21. It happened in Gombe City. The station was crowded with holiday travelers when the attack took place. No one has claimed responsibility, but the Monday attack occurred in northeastern Nigeria, where the Islamist extremist group Boko Haram has repeatedly targeted civilians in its effort to carve out an Islamic state. Meantime, in neighboring Cameroon, the army says its forces have dismantled a Boko Haram training camp in the country's far north along the border with Nigeria. Boko Haram has expanded operations to include attacks on Cameroon in recent months. A Roman Catholic archbishop in the Central African Republic fought with a militiaman who was threatening to kill a Muslim child, according to an eyewitness of the incident. Outnumbered and unarmed, the Archbishop of Bangui and his medical team, who had been helping people in the area, held off what was described as a bloodthirsty mob. Nick Long has more on the story from Bangui.
Archbishop Diodone Nzapalainga had spent 4 days with his medical team giving free care to hundreds of people in villages around the town of Yaloke, about 225 kilometres from Bangui. One of the settlements was predominantly Pearl, a Muslim ethnic group that has sided with the Seleka rebels in the past 2 years of conflict. The Pearl community has been a frequent target of the mostly Christian anti-Balaka militia. While in the village, the Archbishop and his team decided to take a sick 8-year-old girl with her parents to Bangui to be treated at the hospital. Although the team had the protection of UN peacekeepers in the villages, their travel to and from Bangui was without any kind of military escort. Returning to Bangui, the Archbishop and his team were stopped by the anti-Balaka at a roadblock 26 kilometres north of Bangui. A doctor with the team, Elkana Ndawacha, tells VOA what happened next.
C'était horrible l'acte que nous avons vu de la part de nos frères les anti-Balaka. Ils avaient une grenade en main.
He says it was horrible. The anti-Balaka had a grenade and they threatened to throw it at our cars if the group tried to leave. They also had knives, he says, and they dragged a Pearl out of one of the cars and were going to kill him. And Ndawacha says Archbishop Nzapalainga intervened and grabbed the arm of the man who was about to draw a knife. The man pulled out the knife and the Archbishop was left holding the sheath. The doctor tells the OA that the 8 people with the Archbishop had to argue and fight with the 10 anti-Balaka for 10 minutes before they could get away.
Et nous sommes battus avec les anti-Balaka pour les empêcher de ne pas tuer les Pearls que nous avons dans la voiture.
He says finally they got the Pearl back into the car and fled with them in 2 vehicles, while the Archbishop stayed behind with the other 2 cars and restrained the anti-Balaka. A local journalist who also witnessed the incident, Yovis Uwakara, confirmed the account. The sick girl made it to the Archbishop's house and was transferred to a hospital. Ndawacha says the incident happened next to a roadblock manned by Central African police or gendarmes. Many observers have questioned the neutrality of the Central African security forces in the CAR's sectarian conflict. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
And blues and rock and roll singer Joe Cocker has died of lung cancer at the age of 70. British-born singer who was known for his rendition of the Beatles song With a Little Help from My Friends had a distinctive throaty growl when he sang. Rose to fame in the mid-1960s and built a career that spanned 40 years, and in 2007, he was knighted by Queen Elizabeth for his contribution to British music. A statement from Sony Music says Cocker was at his home in the U.S. state of Colorado when he died late Sunday. That's a look at some of the stories making news this hour. There's always more at voanews.com.
This is Business News on VOA Global with Ira Melman. I'm Jim Stevenson. Modest gains on Wall Street Monday pushed the S&P 500 and Dow Jones Industrial Average to record closes. The main indices booked their fourth straight day of gains as investors continued to bet on an accommodative interest rate policy from the Federal Reserve after the central bank last week reassured investors that it will be patient about the timing and pace of rate hikes. Trading volumes were low in a holiday-shortened week, while losses in energy sector stocks and limited gains. The S&P 500 closed up nearly 8 points, or 0.38%, at 2078. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 154.51 points to close at 17,959, and the NASDAQ Composite also up 16 points at 4781.
Oil prices slumped again Monday as comments about maintaining oil production from several OPEC ministers sparked a renewed sell-off. The Saudi Energy Minister Ali Al-Naimi said the Persian Gulf nation will maintain its oil production and may even increase it if a new client emerges. The comment is the latest signal that the largest oil producer is unlikely to cut production in response to a massive drop in prices.
Fewer Americans bought homes in November as buying slid to its slowest pace in 6 months. The National Association of Realtors said Monday that sales of existing homes fell 6.1% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 4.93 million. That was down from a revised annual pace of 5.26 million in October. Over the past 12 months, sales have risen about 2.1%.
And the French firm Alstom SA has pleaded guilty and will pay $772 million in criminal penalties to settle charges with the U.S. Justice Department alleging the company bribed government officials to win business around the world. That's a look at business from the Voice of America.
This is VOA Global. Yes, it is.
Is that what it's called?
And you're Ira Melman.
And you're Jim Stevenson.
That's
and
right.
What you just heard, that little thing that goes...
Yeah, that's a teaser.
That's a tease for
American Cafe coming up in just a few seconds. And then after that, we'll hear from David Byrd, who has an interesting way that underprivileged kids in New Zealand are being addressed. All that coming your way right now on VOA Global.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Dogs have been called man's best friend, but communication between the species is limited because dogs can't talk. However, researchers have developed a sensitive computer interface that improves two-way communication between a dog and his handler. VOA's Jessica Berman is in the cafe with a story of a device that has applications for everything from search and rescue dogs to training household pets.
A couple of dog lovers who happen to be scientists at North Carolina State University have figured out a way to communicate with dogs. It's not a verbal conversation. It's more tactile. They developed a comfortable harness with a small computer mounted on it that allows dog owners to detect from a distance what Fido is doing and feeling, according to David Roberts.
This involves outfitting this harness with a bunch of sensors that are dedicated to monitoring the environment that the dog is in, as well as monitoring the dog itself, and then also being able to send inputs back to the dog via haptics, so gentle vibrations, much like you would feel when your cell phone goes off in your pocket.
The harness, which can record a dog's heartbeat and temperature and measure its activity level, is controlled wirelessly through a cell phone app. Roberts, a mathematician and computer scientist at NC State, says the device runs two programs and has a number of potential applications. One is to use it with service dogs that guide sight-impaired people. These dogs, says Roberts, are particularly vulnerable to stress, even though they're trained to remain very calm. The high-tech harness can also be used on search and rescue dogs and military dogs trained to locate explosives.
They're running out and they catch a whiff of something. They could be out at several hundred yards working away from the handlers, and the handler could get a little beep on a handheld device saying, hey, your dog is on some scent.
The beep on a cell phone tells the handler that a dog has laid down in front of a scent, as they are trained to do. The harness can be customized with environmental sensors that can detect hazards such as gas leaks, as well as a camera and microphone for collecting additional information. Haptic vibrations can also send precisely timed signals from the handler to help train a dog. Roberts and his colleagues are in the process of miniaturizing the computer and improving the physiological sensors so the harness can be used in animal shelters and hospitals. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Fossils from California's La Brea tar pits keep supplying scientists with excellent material for studying the region's past. Ancient animals, from mammoths to tiny insects, reveal facts about climate changes during the last ice age and help scientists understand the modern climate. VOA's George Putich is here in the cafe with us.
For millennia, natural tar that seeped from the ground in what is now Southern California trapped large and small animals, preserving their fossils and providing scientists with a trove of specimens suitable for study. A researcher at La Brea Tar Pits Museum, Anna Holden, is analyzing fossilized bees to learn about the ancient environment.
I'm trying to reconstruct what the climate was like and also what the local habitat. But this bee offered kind of unprecedented information in a way.
Exposing the fossils in a micro CT scanner, scientists discovered that the bees' habitat was warmer than expected, which led them to conclude that at the end of the Ice Age, about 11,500 years ago, this area was not covered with snow and ice, as previously thought. Holden says that unlike the large mammals that came to La Brea from South America or across the Bering Strait, insects' limited range allows the collection of detailed information about their immediate environment. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Please join us every day at voanews.com and many podcast platforms.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. There's a program in a poor suburb of Auckland, New Zealand, that aims to use music as a way to help underprivileged kids learn not only how to play an instrument, but also how to live. The program is called Sistema Aotearoa, and it's led by professional violinist Dr. Joe Harrop. In the program, youngsters between ages 5 and 15 learn to play musical instruments, give performances, and also learn important life skills like cooperation and time management. Dr. Harrop, himself of Polynesian descent, told the Associated Press the program is both a musical and a social one.
Sistema Aotearoa is a social intervention program that uses the symphony orchestra as a context for social change, social intervention. It's based on the model from Venezuela, El Sistema, but we've adapted it and adopted it in our own way.
Sistema Aotearoa is based on El Sistema, a curriculum devised by Venezuelan José Antonio Abreu in 1975. The children practice music with professionals who also serve as tutors and mentors for the kids. The program is free and is open to children of all musical skill levels. Dr. Joe Harrop says that he hopes the program will help expand the goals and aspirations of the kids who take part.
What we're looking to do is to provide the children of this community with skills and life skills, as it were, to help them progress, lift their aspirations, widen their perception of what's out there.
Harrop told the AP the program uses something the kids are very familiar with, hanging out with others from their community, to help teach children who might have no access to such learning anywhere else.
Learning a musical instrument, and particularly learning a musical instrument in a band or an orchestra, teaches you things along the way about problem solving, not just for yourself with your own instrument, but also how to solve a problem of this musical piece of art with your friends, your colleagues. It also teaches you things like to turn up on time, what it is to work hard towards a goal, to perform well under pressure. You know, when you're up on stage, it's a pressure environment.
Roz Gifney is a child developmental therapist and one of the Sistema Aotearoa program's facilitators. She told the AP that when students come in, they start at the very beginning, learning the parts of a cardboard musical instrument before they move on to the real thing.
We start very slowly when the child first comes, I might show you. They build together with our tutors and with their parents or whānau a cardboard violin. And this violin can be used to teach a great deal. We learn the string names and we learn the parts of the violin and we learn how to hold it.
Gifney says that tutors and mentors also model behavior they hope the students will pick up on, like resolving disputes, respect for others, and working well with a group. Gifney told the AP the kids benefit in all areas of their lives, and their progress can be seen in places outside the orchestra.
Marked areas of change are in areas such as cooperation, communication with adults, confidence. That was a very big one. Schools were the first to say, we can spot the Sistema children. They seem to be more confident. They're more keen to have a go and tackle something that they think that they may not achieve at. So I suppose you could say they're not afraid of failure.
But the program is not just all about music. Kids are fed, they play games, and they are cared for. Cephalina Taito told the AP she has seen her son Ezekiah grow in many ways since he started the Sistema Aotearoa 3 years ago.
I think Ezekiah
has a lot of confidence in themselves, and he's not shy to go up and do things, and it develops his skills of loving music.
A recent study of the program's results said there was promising evidence that Sistema Aotearoa contributes to children's social, developmental, musical, and educational skills. So, what do you think? Had you heard of a program that uses the Sistema approach where you live? Let us know your thoughts by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And you can email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. I'm David Byrd.
How would you like one of our new calendars?
Hey, tell us what you think, Ira.
Well, what I think is that I have one. It's already up.
It's on your desk.
That it is. And I got another one somehow. How I got two, I have no idea. But it's got these gorgeous pictures of the American Southwest all through Arizona, New Mexico, and
claim
Nevada.
Yours for free.
You can get it. What's the
write
address?
Write to us, voaasia@voanews.com. Please write to us. Get your free calendar for 2015. Time for sports on VOA Global. Jim Stevenson along with Ira Melman. Hey, it's playoff time in the National Football League, or just about. The Pittsburgh Steelers and Green Bay Packers both qualifying for the playoffs with wins Sunday, and next week they'll be playing for division titles at home. Defending Super Bowl champion Seattle also qualified by routing Arizona 35-6 and moved into a tie with the Cardinals at 11-4 for the top spot in the NFC West. The Seahawks own the tiebreaker should they both finish with the same record. Meanwhile, Dallas at 11-4 clinched the NFC East with a 42-7 romp past Indianapolis, and that ended any chance, sorry Ira, for Philadelphia to make the playoffs. Pittsburgh beat Kansas City 20-12 to secure at least a wild card berth, and they will win the AFC North if they can defeat Cincinnati next week. The Bengals are 9-4-1. They host Denver on Monday.
NBA action saw Cleveland's LeBron James score 25 points and 11 assists, put in a strong second-half performance to guide the Cavaliers to a 105-91 home victory over NBA Southwest Conference leader Memphis Sunday. Among other games, Washington missed a chance to build a lead in the Southeast when it was beaten at home by Phoenix. New Orleans took a tight victory at Oklahoma City. Toronto down New York to open a 10-game lead in the Atlantic Division.
Cristiano Ronaldo has been a huge force in the sport of football, and, well, now he's got a statue to prove it. He unveiled a statue of himself on his home island of Madeira in Portugal. Ronaldo calls the larger-than-life bronze statue prettier than me, according to a Spanish news agency Europa Press. The 29-year-old Real Madrid forward helped the Spanish team win the Club World Cup in Morocco on Saturday. Ronaldo already has a museum dedicated to his career.
Well, in baseball news, the Pirates have won the rights to negotiate with South Korean shortstop Jung Ho Kang. Pittsburgh has a 30-day window to sign the 27-year-old who hit .354 with 39 homers last season for the Nexon Heroes while being named the MVP of the Korean baseball organization.
And that's a look at sports on VOA Global. We invite you to join us for our segment every week right here on the Voice of America.
From the Voice of America in Washington, I'm Ira Melman with Jim Stevenson. Joe Cocker, the raspy-voiced British singer famous for hit songs like Feeling All Right and Up Where We Belong, has died at the age of 70, according to his management agency. Cocker was famous for both his unique voice and for a soulful style of singing that made it sound like he was pouring his heart out when he put his unique touch on hits like You Are So Beautiful. His fans in the United States may remember his cover of a Beatles tune that was played each week from 1988 to 1993 as the theme for the TV series The Wonder Years. Here it is.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on me? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Yeah. Oh, baby, how do you say I'm gonna get high? I tell you, don't you say it no more. I will help when I pray. Gonna get down and I pray. I will help when I pray. Yeah, 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 I'm gonna try. I will help when I pray. Keep on getting out. Certain it happens all the time, yeah.
What do you see when you turn out the light?
I can't tell you, but it so feels like madness. I promised myself I'd get by. Said I'm gonna try it with.
Joe Cocker, dead at the age of 70. Well, there's a story out there, and it is about Christmas trees. And Christmas trees combined with social media. Twitter users anywhere in the world, you can control the lights on a holiday display in New Jersey. Tweets will turn on a 9-foot Christmas tree, a menorah, and over 1,000 LED lights at Oxford Communications in Lambertville, New Jersey, and also turn them off. Company says it's designed the display with the intention to help charities, towns, and businesses to develop awareness and fundraising campaigns. Now, are you ready? You got to write this down. So you can tweet, hashtag brilliant, hashtag twinkle to @oxmas-tree. That's OXMAS-tree to light the display. And you can tweet, hashtag figgy pudding to turn off the lights.
Now, what if somebody is tweeting to turn them on and somebody else is tweeting to turn them off at the same time?
I can see this thing going on and off and on and off and on and off. And Lord help us if somebody hacks into it. Who knows what's going to happen?
Well, somebody else's internet's been turned off for the moment.
Well, that's going to wrap things up for us for today. With Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman. Make sure you join us every day here on The Voice of America from Washington, D.C. Our thanks today to Tracy Carter, as always, for being our director. And let's see, Diane Gao is our managing director. And Zubir is our technical director. Have a fine day, everybody.
You too. Thanks for joining us.